Hello and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm Holly Rubenstein. I'm a travel journalist and editor. And here each week, I'll be speaking to a very special guest about their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. Today, I'm joined by the historian and broadcaster Dan Snow, who you might know best from his hugely successful podcast, Dan Snow's History Hit. Dan's adventures started at a very young age as he travelled the world with his journalist parents. His dad is a very well-known BBC TV journalist, Peter Snow. And Dan has followed in their footsteps. He's also a mainstay on our TV screens, often presenting shows linked to his love of history. And that in turn has involved a great deal of travel to some fascinating and far-flung locations, from Timbuktu and Zanzibar to Hawaii and St. Helena in the South Atlantic Ocean. So it might come as no surprise then that this is a long-haul episode. You get a bit more this week because Dan has traveled to so many interesting places. I wanted you to hear about all of them. So let's get to it. Here's Dan Snow. Dan Snow, welcome to the Travel Diaries. Thank you so much for being here. How are you?
Very good. I'm really excited. I love this podcast. Well done for everything you've done. And
thank you.
Well, like everybody, love traveling. And so it's great to hear all the other things, advice that your guests have got.
And travel is really a big feature in your life, right?
It is, yeah. I mean, yeah, it is. And what's been joyful about what I do is you get to travel, but you get to have purpose. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of, I'm not a huge fan of travel journalism and even some travel writing, because it's that kind of slightly aimless wandering around I find a bit difficult. And I'm so blessed that when I go somewhere, I've got like a really, like a family holidays I find very odd, because when I start traveling, my wife and kids, I'm like, what am I doing here? Yes. I'm supposed to be relaxing, just spending time with the kid. Okay, fine. But when I go to a country, you land and you're there to see Petra or the Terracotta Warriors. So you're moving through with purpose. You're looking at the stuff you love. Oh, wow, amazing. Just checking this out, checking that out, eating the cuisine. But there's a real sense of mission. And you get there, you get set up, you get there at dawn, you film the volcano, you film the historical ruin, you meet the key veteran of the Second World War, and then you get out. And so it is travel, but it has this wonderful intellectual kind of narrative, like driving force that goes through it.
It's interesting how so much history is the kind of formative basis for so much of travel, really.
Yes, well, actually, you're right. So, I spend most of my life like justifying why I'm a history geek and people thinking it's weird. But of course, it's actually not when you delve into it. Like, why do people go where they go? And we know, for example, that Asian visitors coming to Europe are here. Number one, apparently, is kind of the shopping and kind of luxury accommodation experience. But number two is apparently history and heritage, right? Mm-hmm. They want to see French Chateau, they want to see Versailles, they want to see Tower of London, they want to see Big Ben, they want to see, you know, the beautiful, you know, German, perfect Alpine villages in Bavaria and Switzerland and stuff. So, of course, that's why we all go to places. We all, you know, if you think people are going to Venice, they might not be engaging with the historical narrative and like reading books about Venice, but why do they want to go to Venice? They want to be surrounded by that, the fabric of history, right? Mm-hmm. So you're absolutely right. People go to Amsterdam. Oh, I love going to Amsterdam. Well, they're going to Amsterdam. It's not an accident. They're going to one of the most beautiful and historic places in the world,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely. It's the architecture.
Yeah,
it's the heritage.
The vibe and the, exactly, and the extraordinary.
And the canals.
And the canals. Mm.
So let's start at the very beginning, first of all, with your travels. And that is chapter one, which is your earliest childhood travel memory.
Well, I think it's an inside UK memory, this one. Oh, well, I don't know. Probably my earliest memory is driving up to my family in North Wales. My mum was born in North Wales and her family, mm-hmm. many of her cousins things still live there in the hills, sheep farmers up in North Wales.
What's it like there topographically?
Well, it's Snowdonia, so it's big. Well, I say, if you're listening to this abroad, everyone, they're not big mountains, but in England, Wales, we would consider them big mountains. They're big hills, some mountains, wild landscapes, no trees, not very few trees, grazed, lots of sheep. Rock extrusions, patches of grass, the sea down on the coast, surrounded on three sides, not only by the sea. So, we'd drive up there, and back in the day, you know, you were in the boot of the car, obviously, you know, child seats. So you're in a boot, I'm in the boot of the car with my sisters, other sisters and brothers in the back seat. listening to a radio cassette or something, and sort of being asleep and waking up and still on the road and driving over these little winding roads and then getting there, and it was like 10 degrees colder than where you'd left from. In the middle, it was like a day's worth of travel to get there. And it always now, to the minute, this day seems like the most remote place on earth. And it's actually very easy to get there nowadays. But and so that kind of sense of travel and leaving somewhere comfortable and arriving somewhere completely different is something that stayed with me forever.
And did you enjoy it, or was it kind of a bit of a schlep?
No, I don't remember enjoying. People always say to me, did you enjoy all these weird things with your parents? Because we did loads of adventures and travels to all sorts of weird parts of the world. And
I was going to ask, so both your parents are journalists, yeah. So was travelling more a feature in your childhood than perhaps like the average person?
Oh yeah, we did lots of travel. We didn't really go on holidays like normal. Our dream was to go to a beach and meet other children and play with them, and that never happened. And to this day, I have done that with my kids, and I see them having a very normal, like enrolling them in the day club, you know, on the beach
club,
thing,
yeah.
Kids club, and they play football. And I look at them going, that is the weirdest thing I've ever seen. What are they doing?
Yeah.
I've never had that experience. So they were both journalists. So we used to go to Northern Ireland a lot, you know, and it was during the Troubles. We went to the Middle East during the pretty hot phase of the Intifada. I mean, we just did lots of stuff like that. So, and I weirdly don't remember. Everyone says, oh, you must be amazing. That's why you became a sort of lover of history. And I go, I don't think I particularly enjoy it. I just was like kids. I don't think my kids enjoy the place I take them to. They just do it. They just kind of... roll with it. And then you kind of remember the weird... You infuriate my dad by... The highlight would be like playing with the plastic dinosaur in the yeah. place in the airport. And then you come back from holiday and dad would be like, what are your best and worst of the holiday? Let's write them all down. And the kids would all come up with the most, and like playing on the baggage reclaim thing. And dad would go mental because he'd just shown us this amazing kind of Crusader castle in Jordan or something. So yeah, but first memory I think is driving up on those long weekends to Wales or feeling violently seasick, sailing our boat across the Channel to France, either of those two.
Oh, so you were going across to where in France?
I mean, my dad is he was a sort of workaholic journalist, and he took all of his holiday in one go. He took 5 weeks every summer, which there's no politics that happens in the summer, so he could take the time off.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd get on this little tiny boat, 37-foot boat, and we would sail. We wouldn't go and meet other people and swim in the sea. Like, we'd just sail as a family to incredibly weird places on the west coast of Ireland or north coast of Norway or in France. And I remember, and there were no GPS in those days, right? So old. And dad would be there in heaven, classical music blaring, smoking a pipe, steering through the night with these paper charts sort of blowing around the wind. No, I mean, no idea where we were in those days. And then,
wow.
And then we would just be being violently seasick down below.
Oh, God.
And just crawling around and just wishing we were dead. And that's normal. And my wife goes, you have a brutalized, you know, you have no idea. You're not arranging any holidays because you're a traumatized human and you've got Stockholm syndrome. But for me, and I found adult life very easy because nothing is as appalling as those family sailing holidays. Like just lying there being sick with my sisters in a bunk for hours on end.
How was that enjoyable for your parents though?
I don't think it was. And my mum did not enjoy it. But
your dad just persevered.
My dad he's having a lovely time because he had that. He was that generation. He just blocked all the kids, didn't sort of feature very highly. So he's sort of smoking a pipe, watching the world go by, waves crashing everywhere. Fantastic. And then I just look back. I mean, if I tried to do that to my wife and kids now, I'd face like full uproar. It'd be like a rebellion.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's no chance.
No, even me now, actually, any place where I could be seasick is an absolute no-no.
I know, it's just awful. But I say, adult life, you know, I'm filming for the BBC and everyone's like, oh, that was really, you know, did this and that. And I go, honestly, I mean, compared to being a six-year-old in a bunk being sick everywhere and thinking you're going to die in a storm, I mean, this is just a piece of cake. I mean, it's absolutely pleasant.
So chapter two, then, is the first place that you fell in love with.
Well, I think that would be... I think it's a big word, isn't it, falling in love? Because I think it implies adult. I don't think as a kid I fell in love with that, you know, fell in love with a culture and a place. And I think as I took a year off after high school, after our secondary school, and I went to traveling around Africa and all that sort of stuff, backpacking.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to Zanzibar and it blew my mind. So I didn't really know that there was that East African, Arab, Islamic culture. I just hadn't registered as an 18-year-old. Shockingly. The combination of kind of Middle Eastern architecture, food, religion, and people, and sub-Saharan African, the fusion was electrifying. The spice is on the spice route. It just was like a sort of coming of age experience. So I was walking through these streets. I had a little creaky, I'll never forget it. And I had this little, you know, room, these heavy wooden shutters and the old ceiling fan creaking round. And I just felt like a total, I felt like the rest of my life had started.
Wow.
This is it. This is the start gun.
So at that stage, had it been developed so that there were kind of luxury resorts?
No, I don't. Are they now in Zanzibar? I'm not sure.
Oh,
I haven't been back for 20 years.
It's very much like a honeymoon destination
really?
Now. Yeah.
I'm not surprised because it's the world's best. I mean, the Old Town is just the coolest place I've been in my whole life. No, it was absolutely not. There was one very posh hotel in the Old Town. I remember that, where some Americans were staying, who I met when I was out drinking one night. And then we went up to the beachy area at the north of the island, I think. I haven't really engaged with it since. I was going to.
You should go back.
Well,
I think. It will probably have changed so much. I wonder whether you'll think it's for the better.
I know, I wonder. Well, I mean, you have to hope that if it's done well, of course, ethical, you know, tourism is a massive industry and hopefully
exactly.
it brings enormous wealth and opportunities to people living there. So I hope it is done well, but or unlike a place like, say, Jamaica, where it's like a sort of prison camp and you're not quite sure who's in the camp, the tourists or the local people, but it's a bit crap for both, I think.
Mm.
And, you know, people are denied access to the beach and local kids are playing in like the little sewage outlets. That's awful. So I hope it hasn't been done like that. But yeah, I sort of just thought this was the life I wanted to lead, really. You know, I was kind of exploring in myself and traveling and then I was reading books that were sort of, you know, like I was actually reading The Moore's Last Cyber, Salman Rushdie, and it was all about spice and falling in love and being having wonderful adventures. And I just changed my life, really. And I thought, I just knew I loved being around heritage spaces at that point. I knew that for my mental wellness and for my intellectual curiosity and for my general happiness, I just loved being in there rather than a strip mall in Idaho.
That's interesting. So is that was that the point where you would say that you fell in love with history as well, to a point?
I think in some ways, yeah. I mean, I'd always done history at school and I was off to do history at university and stuff, but I mean, as a thing to study, I enjoyed history. But that gave me a sense of that you could wrap it all up with a travel, a lifestyle, like a history lifestyle. Of course, I had no idea I was going to be lucky enough to do what I'm doing now, but that there was a world, there was a life that was possible where you could love history and that would actually take you to historical places and experience and feel them in a way that you couldn't just in a library or from a textbook.
So you've brought history to the masses, obviously, Dan, with your hugely successful History Hit podcast and your online history channel as well. And these, you say, feature reports from the weird and wonderful places around the world where history has been made. Which has been some of the most memorable, would you say?
Well, memorable. In 2018, I went to Timbuktu with the International Committee of the Red Cross.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. That's one of those places that I can't picture it at all. Tell me what it's like.
Well, that's interesting. It's fascinating to say that. So, weirdly, it's what's weird about Timbuktu is it is a sort of imaginary place for people. But that's actually what it's been like for hundreds of years. It was always in the West for some bizarre reason. Maybe the name, maybe the stories of gold. It was a place that featured, loomed very large in imaginations in Western Europe particularly. And so it is a place where famously it's in Mali, and one historian in Mali told me that it's a place where the camels met the canoes. So the camels of the North African Berbers coming across the desert, these camel trains across the desert, the Sahara, entered the sort of West African space, so the sort of sub-Saharan African, very different culture, religion, stuff like that, and it's where that exchange point was made. So it got they got rich.
Right.
So it's a place where, you know, Africans would, as we would know, sub-Saharan Africans would come north, bringing ivory and slaves and gold and things, and then they would exchange them for, you know, the produce of what we now call Arab North Africa or of Western Europe. So there was this extraordinary place of exchange that grew fabulously wealthy, and it was amazing. University town, literary tradition grew up, astonishing written tradition there, all the scrolls and manuscripts and things that famously are in the news and were saved from destruction by the jihadists. It's mud built, they mix the butter. There's a beautiful mosque there. It's about 700 years old, which because the buildings are alive, because every time it rains, they just scoop more mud out and patch them up and they evolve. And
wow.
So it's fascinating. And they mix butter in with it. So the walls are sort of like just you want to touch them. And so then they, and the town itself is astonishing. You know, some very old, obviously lots of things damaged now and, you know, in war and stuff, you know, bits of stainless steel, bits of sort of corrugated iron stuff coming in now. But, you know, traditionally, mud built, mud bricks, wood, beautiful wooden doors, famously, very, very well known for its kind of wooden doors. It's a wonderful place, but it's, you know, completely now at the moment lawless. The North, you know, the sort of jihadists that captured much of northern Mali were driven out by the French army, but same story you've heard so many other places. The kind of effective Mali state has not been built to replace it, so it's just kind of chaotic and anarchic now. But I was able to go there because of the Red Cross. The BBC wouldn't be able to go there. No one would be able to go there. So
really,
but yeah. So
what were you doing while you were there?
Well, I was. They did offer to take me, and in return, I, you know, talked about what they were up to, and then the deal was I could also do some filming and podcasting, and so it was a nice, really nice combination.
And did you feel unsafe?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, you do feel unsafe when you're in those kind of war zones, you know, all those conflict areas, all those unstable areas. Mm. We had to avoid the main road. We had to take all this, you know, back to the... There'd been a huge bomb when we landed, actually. There'd been a huge bomb which torn the airport, the terminal building apart. A few months before we landed. And then we had to sort of take all these kind of back routes and drive really, really fast and stuff like that. And the vehicle, the Red Cross vehicle, was actually carjacked and stolen.
That you were travelling with?
A few months ago. Yeah, no, not the one I was in it, but a few months doing that same route, it was carjacked. But such is the respect for the Red Cross, it was actually returned, interestingly, because they spend so much time working, establishing neutrality. So they are talking to these jihadi groups, they'll work with them. And I went to actually a prison in Bamako, the capital of Mali, where lots of jihadists in northern... from these northern territories are imprisoned, and I went there when they were the Red Cross, and they write to their families, they represent them to the Malian government, you know, so they have established trust and respect, you know, just one sort of day at a time. It's amazing the work they do. What else? My goodness, I had it. Yeah, Egypt last year was great. 2019 was fun. It's always lovely, the anniversary stuff, going to the D-Day beach on the anniversary of the 75th anniversary of the D-Day invasion last year, meeting the veterans, podcasting away. I mean, the great thing, and you're learning this, and one thing hopefully people at home enjoy about podcasts is the kind of intellectual freedom that people like you are given, because, you know, when you work at Radio 4 or the BBC, you're just everything's just smashed and ripped and edited and cut and slashed down to nothing. So, you know, I interviewed the guy who dropped the torpedo at the Bismarck for the one show once, and we went to his house in Scotland to interview him for 3 hours, most amazing man, and it's like 20 seconds on the one show that night.
Yeah. Terrifying. I mean, I used to be a TV producer, so I'm very familiar with that feeling, your hit being dropped last minute from a live show.
Totally.
Soul destroying.
And you know, and actually, but when you're out on the D-Day beach, it's just so nice to just give these veterans the airtime that you think they might deserve, and the audience... Yeah. Kind of agree, and you don't have to worry about the big general audience. You're not worrying about, like, when I was at the BBC, you're like, oh, what's, are 3 million people going to watch this? But I don't care. No, this is for people who are listening to this pod, who, in this, your case, they love travel. In my case, they just really, really like history, and they're prepared to kind of go with it and listen to these old guys. And if some of the stories take a while to get done, you don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, they love it. They get involved.
Yeah.
So chapter three, then, is the trip where you learnt the most about yourself.
I mean, I've been a lot. You do a lot of self-learning when you travel, don't you?
Yeah.
And funnily enough, it's not like an A level. It's never like I've done the module. I've learned about myself. Partly because
ever evolving.
Partly because we're always changing, and partly because there's a lot to learn. And I'm a different human to the one I was 20 years ago. So you do have to learn that. Like, I'm now learning when I climb up a huge mountain that I have to give myself slightly more time than I did when I was 18.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a learning, an unpleasant learning. I think, though, it would be. Again, that kind of formative period, 18, 19, I went out and summers at university, I'd go out and work in the west of Canada in a mountain lodge.
Oh, interesting. Where in Canada?
In the Rocky Mountains, a place called Assiniboine Provincial Park. If you're ever lucky enough to go there, it's the world's most beautiful place. I took my wife back there and proposed to her when we were going out.
Oh,
it's my
amazing.
Favorite place on earth. Yeah. But for some reason, it's not famous. Like, it's not like, you know, it looks like Lake Louise and the other ones? Lake Louise and...
Banff and Jasper.
There's some of those kind of famous backcountry lodges where you go and you do the hiking, stay, and the lake is cerulean blue, fantastic. And you never see Mount Assiniboine on that list. It's just outside Canmore. It's maybe less fashionable. The lodge is a bit more rustic. When I was there was no running hot water and stuff, but it's beautiful food and a bit like cosy, and just they got it absolutely right. It's now a little bit more jazzy, I think. And that is... you know, I lived up there for 3 months, up in, you know, above the tree line in alpine meadows with spray of wildflowers there, and with a bunch of other Canadian 20-year-olds.
Amazing. And what drew you to that?
Well, I'm half Canadian. My mum's Canadian. Right. So I had the passport. So I thought, well, if I'm going to do a summer job, might as well make it really, you know, try and have fun and not just work in a shop in London like all my mates did. So I went and did that and made lots of money and tips. And I was chambermaiding and then prep chefing in the kitchen and doing a little bit of guiding, helping out the guiding and stuff. And then in the afternoon, when we finished our work about midday, we could just go and spend the whole afternoon in the mountains. And it's like, we just went, there was no like telly or downtime. So we all immediately like rushed from the kitchen, having done prep the dinner that night. And then we'd all just throw on our hiking boots and then just hike up into the mountains and walk across glaciers and find out little, go and look at caves and try and spot grizzly bears chasing ground squirrels. And with all these like super cool Canadians, and they taught me, you know, I'm a lot of my kind of, I don't know, views on life and music and social views are all there. And I met my sort of first lesbian friend who, you know, she had a partner up there working together, you know, all this kind of stuff that maybe I hadn't had exposure to growing up in Southwest London, a kind of suburb. It changed my life. And it was, yeah, and I try not to be a pushy dad, but I would love my kids to go and do something like that as well. But
yeah. Would you ever live in Canada, do you think?
The older I get, no, I'm like a salmon. I'm like a demon. I'm like Lyra's demon changing in Northern Lights. I've changed. I used to change shape all the time and I would have been happy to live anywhere. And now my shape is set and I love where I live. It's now just ingrained. I love this stupid little island we live on with its crazy politics and its mad views on things. And I love its crap weather. I don't mind. And I drive down. I love London, this city we're sitting in now, where I was born. And I'm lucky enough now to live in the New Forest. And I drive down, get the train usually, and get back to where I live. And there's a howling southwesterly gale blowing. And the oak trees, and I know what time of year it is just by looking at what's growing and what's out and what birds are around. And I think I couldn't live anywhere else.
New Forest is so beautiful.
Yeah, no, it's beautiful. But also, Tuscany's nicer. California's nicer. Yeah, Las Vegas are nicer. But I'm done. This is me. And it's just what it is. And actually, I'm at peace with that. And I love, obviously, love travel. There's my favourite expression in the world. It's so annoying people sort of quote pop psychology, but this is my bit. Is a 19th century sort of very leading, a sort of early adopter of psychiatry. He said, life is best organized as a series of daring adventures from a secure base. Mm. And that, when I read that, it was electrifying.
Yeah.
Totally true. Like, I don't, when you go to Mali, when I've been to Syria during the civil war, you go to the Congo, it's extraordinary, terrifying, can be life-affirming, but only if you've got somewhere safe to go back to and happy and safe, and I do. And so that is kind of how I've...
That's a great philosophy for any traveller.
Isn't it the best?
Yeah, I love that. Love that. Right.
I nicked it off the internet, so this is you're more than welcome to claim it as...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like, last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb. So chapter four then is your all-time favourite destination, my favourite chapter.
This is the hardest chapter for me because everyone wants me to say Petra, Angkor Wat, Pyramids, Valley of the Kings, Terracotta Warriors, whatever it might be. And I've got a very embarrassing problem, which is I absolutely love Hawaii.
That's not embarrassing. That's one of the most beautiful places in the world.
But I just think it's great.
Which island do you like the best?
Maui, probably.
Maui.
It is a wonderful, it's a wonderful mix of culture, of landscape, of sea, of biodiversity, of volcanoes, but also, and this is important, accessibility. Like I love hiking in Nepal or Indian Himalayas, right? But it's, you come around the corner and there's just like this massive rubbish tier, or the path disappears, or like this really brutal exploitation by some horrible multinational company have like torn the top of a mountain, like mining, and you're like, oh, that's such a buzzkill.
Yeah.
It's really, and like, I know it's hard to do. Whereas, actually, so you want about, well, some Americans. America at its best has got this, that access, and there's nowhere better. You go to a national park there and you've got like, this is it, these are the maps, go fill your boots, kayak, do the thing. And I it's the most amazing place to get outdoors. And Britain's caught up a lot, actually, but it's certainly 20-30 years ago.
The hiking culture, even the hiking, in the US, yeah. It's just part of everyday life there,
and it's accessible.
It?
You get on a bus, they drop you off and you're like, how do I get back from here? Like, oh, every day we pick up from here and this is the map and this is what you got to do. And obviously phones have made all that a lot easier. But certainly, before we all had supercomputers in our pocket and could summon drivers at the click of, it was difficult. The countryside was inaccessible. And particularly in Britain, that you had to be a sort of posh bloke who knew it and got used to it. But in America, I've always found it, and Canada, you just like, it's very democratic. It is set up. There are national parks, they are yours. And you can go in there. And I found Hawaii was just brilliantly set up. If you want to just, on a budget, just get out into some amazing landscape without, you can do it there. I think now that's true of New Zealand, that's true of lots of places now, and actually it's much better in the UK.
Did you go to Mount Kilauea?
I did not, actually.
Next time you go to Kauai and go to the volcano there, the active volcano, Mount Kilauea.
Oh yes, of course, I'd love to do that.
That is amazing, that. Walking over that kind of lava field. As you say, with Hawaii, from island to island, every island is so different.
So different.
The Big Island is so kind of steamy and tropical.
I know.
And then
the other thing is that surfing was invented there, which is a reason, because it's really easy there. So I got on a surfboard, and surfing is the best thing in the world. And I got on a surfboard in Oahu, off Honolulu, on a really big longboard. And the guy's like, okay, just do this. And I did it. I stood up all the way to the shore. And I'm like, oh, awesome. My God, because the break is sweet. And I'm like, I can surf. I never thought I was going to be that guy. And sometimes, I'm sure you'll have it when you're traveling. You had an image when you're in your head when you're a kid. And I used to have No Fear, that fashion brand, who I think may still exist, but I don't used to. I used to have No Fear posters in my room, beaten paths for beaten men. And there was this guy like skiing off this gnarly thing, all this powder. And then when I finally got the courage up to ski off piste and gnarly powder, I remember thinking, when I was a kid, I dreamt about being that guy. And it's a reminder that if you want something in life, if you want to be something, if you want to be a podcast, if you want to be an individual, you want to leave or partly leave mainstream journalism behind and try and stake something out for yourself, you can do that. Like, you can achieve that. And that's what travel has kind of taught me. And I, so there's times when you're on an amazing boat going between islands in Hawaii, or you're skiing, or you're surfing on Honolulu, you think, oh, I wanted to be that guy, and now I'm kind of that guy. I'm so excited.
Yeah, you're realizing a dream.
Yeah, and it's real. And actually, the best thing of all is it turns out that, unlike some Instagram gratification, it is as good as you thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
So you're surfing and you're like, and it's awesome.
Yeah.
I thought it was going to be awesome, and it is. And then you go for a beer on the beach with nice, cool people in Hawaii. Oh, anyway, so that's my embarrassing secret. I've never really told anyone that.
Well, thank you for sharing.
Well, I'm feeling better about myself now. Thank you, because you're the expert, and I'm glad to hear you approve on that.
How about a favourite city?
Well, I was in Amsterdam last year, which I've got to say, I mean, I suppose lurking a lot, maybe it's getting older. What is really wonderful about being, many of the things wonderful about being based in Britain is, you know what? You don't have to ever, if someone said to me tomorrow, you're never allowed to get on a plane ever again, I would go, fine, not a problem. By train, boat, car, bicycle, you have got Norway, Ireland, France, Italy, Spain, Germany, Belgium, like Holland, Denmark, like, those are the best. Like, I'm almost looking forward to being old and crusty and refusing to ever go to an airport again, because you could see 10,000 lifetimes of beauty and culture and fun and food and all of those places. So in terms of great cities, I got to say, they don't come better for me than your Parises, your Amsterdams, your Copenhagens. I can't get enough of them, really. And I certainly prefer them to the slightly fashionable mega city propped up by slave labor, Dubai's, sort of Shanghai's, Kuala Lumpur's, that people quite like, with the kind of ultra exotic, you know, high end tourism. Do you want to swim on a swimming pool on a roof whilst like drinking a caipirinha? Like, no, not really. I just think I'm really worried about air pollution. I'm really worried about work environmental and social and workplace standards in these countries. It's grim. Like, I don't want to go up and be served by some really sad looking Nepalese person in Bahrain, like a giant cocktail. Like, that freaks me out.
And so I
do think when you go into a place in Amsterdam and you chat to the server there, and she's just a cool local person from Amsterdam who lives in a wicked flat around the corner, and you're like, yes, I feel this is kind of more ethical, and the beauty, the time hallowed kind of beauty, the museums, which I'm obviously into, and so yeah. But if you need one answer, just because I was there recently, I will go with Amsterdam, probably.
We're on such the same wavelength. That's my favourite city.
Really?
Be.
Okay.
Yeah,
well, that's, I mean, how could it
And
not
now
be?
You can get there on the Eurostar, even better.
Which I did the other day, and it's just beyond cool.
So nice.
I mean,
so quick.
Have a quick beer in like a beautiful station in London when it was built. St Pancras was the largest enclosed space on planet Earth.
Really?
Yeah, single span, that extraordinary arch. And you have a sophisticated beer there in a nice bar. You get on a train, chill out, do some work, do some podcasting, do what you got to do, and then you get off in Amsterdam.
Yeah.
I mean...
Yeah. The great thing about Amsterdam is that it's one of those cities where you keep turning street corners and the beauty continues.
Oh, yeah,
there are so many cities where there are pockets, but it just is so pervasive.
It's so real. I know. And unfortunately, the Second World War and the Industrial Revolution and modern planning has done for so many cities around the world and Europe. But when you go to a place like those Tuscan hilltop villages or you obviously Amsterdam or Bath, in Britain it's tough, but maybe York or Edinburgh, they are so special, and especially the history lover in me. But I think everyone like gravitates to those places.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you think of what we lost really very recently. You know, we lost so recently. We lost Mandalay, you know, another word, like Timbuktu, another word that just stirs up. Imagine, you know, the British burnt Mandalay in the Second World War.
Yeah.
And it was this unimaginable treasure. We've lost, you know, the cities like some of the Middle East cities like Cairo and Amman have just been sort of trashed. And anyway, but it's important to say, because a lot of people think, oh, it's right for you, you know, people need development. But it's really important to say that if you look at rent yields, if you look at where people are happier and wealthier, it is actually in heritage spaces. So we were wrong to smash up medieval winding streets, because it turns out that young, funky people like your generation want to live and work in those places.
Mm.
And that's where the interesting business are being started up. It's where, and that's where office space costs more, accommodation space. So actually there is a clear economic benefit as well as a kind of arty-farty cultural and historic benefit as well. So
mm-hmm.
so you've got to be really muscular about preserving that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Are you a hotel guy?
I was never a hotel guy, and I'm getting a bit soft in my old age. And my wife's like a bit of a hotel person, so I'm getting kind of into it annoyingly. I used to just love sleeping on the floor somewhere. But so,
I read that you said that once in an interview, and I thought, did you really love sleeping on the floor?
Yeah, I just did. I did. Again, I think it's probably partly the secure base thing, because I was always very privileged. I had a lovely, cozy place to come back to.
Mm-hmm.
And in my 20s, I lived in a little flat in Earls Court with all my mates, and wonderful.
Yeah.
So yeah, going on away, I was always thrilled to sleep anywhere, on the floor, on trains, it was great. So, and now I have to say, my wife will laugh when she hears this, I do now realise that holidays are supposed to be a time to sort of slightly recharge.
Yeah.
I've always seen them, growing up, there was a sort of, me and my sisters used to go back to school to chill out. We absolutely love term time. Fantastic.
Right.
But now, so there is something nice. You know, I went to India a couple of years ago and we went to stay in a few of those Oberoi hotels.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the one in Jaipur, the Oberoi in Jaipur, is one of the nicest places I've ever been in my goddamn life.
Really?
I mean, I just lay there and sort of surrounded by bougainvillea and just birds cheeping and just the richness of Indian culture kind of, or a version of it, obviously, surrounded by that. And I just thought, this is pretty close to paradise.
Yeah. So is that your most memorable hotel stay?
Funnily enough, it is actually. It was a very stressful time at work. I just started this podcast and this History Channel. I think I was filming out there and my wife came to join me. There was some reason I was there. Anyway, and we just went there and the weight of the world sort of lifted from my shoulders. And I thought, this is just amazing, eating the Indian food and stuff. And then little adventures with the kids. And the kids were just old enough. It was the first time I'd ever taken the kids to a country which was, you know, where it was really fundamentally different to the one they'd grown up in. And mm-hmm. they were sort of eyes opened. So that was one of the great trips. And I've got to say, that hotel was really nice.
So what is your hidden gem, Dan? Chapter 5.
I've travelled to so many places, it's very hard to pick a hidden gem. For chilling, like going to, like, obviously, there are islands that I've sailed to off the coast of Thailand, which are just sort of heavenly. But then it feels like a hidden... Oh, God. And does it have to be like literally one place, or is that a country?
Whatever you want it to be. A place that isn't on people's radar, that you thought was amazing, that maybe they should discover themselves.
I don't really know what's hidden. I mean, I would definitely say Iceland is a sort of hidden gem, but maybe it's not that hidden. Everyone wants to go to Iceland, and it is absolutely as good as the PR suggests.
Did you go to any parts of rural Iceland?
Yeah. We were making a program at the Vikings, so we were traveling all over the shop looking at Viking archaeology and speeding around on boats around the coast, and just, it is astonishing. Watching the Northern Lights in a hot spring, drinking a beer, it's just heavenly. I mean, I'm a big fan of all the Scandinavian countries. I mean, it's funny that to me, the Brits, I don't know where most of your listeners are in the world, but if they're British, you know, they all fly off to New Zealand the whole time and been all over the place, Greece, Egypt. But I mean, so few of them have been to the Scandinavian countries. I mean, Sweden, Finland, Norway. I mean, expensive, but like, astonishing. And culturally, like, it's scary. You feel like you're at home. I guess the Stockholm archipelago. Stockholm and its archipelago would be a hidden gem.
Oh, I've heard that's so beautiful.
Got to check. That's probably the most underrated place I've been in my life. Like, I don't understand why everyone doesn't go there the whole time.
So if you were to make that a travel plan for next year, what would you suggest that someone does if they want to experience the beauty of the Stockholm archipelago?
I would go to Stockholm. I would check out Lycansdam, Copenhagen, one of Europe's great cities.
Yeah.
It's got the single greatest museum on planet Earth in it, the Vasa Museum, with a 17th century battleship capsized about 30 seconds after leaving port on its maiden voyage. And because of the cold Baltic Sea, it's perfectly preserved. It is nuts. It's like the Goonies. It's crazy. And then you go out on a boat, either one yourself or one of the many boats that Beatles about, and you just go to one of the islands. And there's islands from an island the size of a rock with a little sauna built on it, by whom you don't know, and there's a little stack of firewood outside, and you just replenish the firewood when you leave and have a sauna, jump in the Baltic, to bigger islands with hotels and restaurants and things on them. But I mean, it's just the best. It's thousands of islands, and it is the people are amazing, the food is amazing, the weather is amazing. It's got it all. But I've got one other little really unfashionable hidden gem, which is actually just, you know, the UK. It's explore where you're from. Yeah. Everyone always wants me to talk about Angkor Wat and pyramids or whatever, but one of the great blessings I've had is exploring this country right from top to toe. I mean, I've spent tons of time in Northumberland and Lancashire, you know, the weird and wonderful corners of this country you get to go to, you know, mackerel fishing museums and things. And a lot of tourism into Britain, like, I mean, tourism, like mainstream, is tough. They land in London, they take in a show, in one day, as I understand it, there's a coach who will pick you up and you will do Stonehenge, but Windsor Castle, Stonehenge, Bath.
In a day.
Wow. And because I went and filmed in Bath and they were like, we have a nightmare here because our visitors are furious. They're late. They've had a they're slightly disappointed by Stonehenge. Anyway, and then they've just been in traffic and they arrived, they're grumpy. So Bath is like, yay, Roman Bath. And they have a real issue. And I just think that just sounds so grim. So if you're listening to this abroad and you're coming to the UK, don't fly into London. I wouldn't maybe not even go to London. Go to like York, Newcastle, Durham, Hadrian's Wall. There's villages up there, the Yorkshire Moors, and then fly out of Edinburgh and you will check out the borders. That is a hidden gem, and I bet more Londoners have been to New Zealand than have been to that part of the country.
Very, very true. Great hidden gems. So in contrast then, chapter 6 is the place that you would never go back to.
I don't want to get all political, but I do find China problematic at the moment, you know, with its issues around Hong Kong and the way it's treating the Uyghurs in the west of the country. And so I think ethically I'm struggling now to kind of go to China at the moment. I'm not in a hurry to go back to the places where I've been scared to death in war zones, you know, making TV shows like Congo and Syria. Syria is obviously one of the world's most beautiful, well, both of those, two of the world's most beautiful countries. But I had experiences there that make me nervous about going back.
Amazing how Syria was an up-and-coming tourist destination until very recently.
Totally. I mean, it was the big thing. It was the thing to do in the late 2000s, before the Arab Spring.
Yeah.
It was people really discovering it. I mean, it was a secular country
where... And the history, I imagine.
Unparalleled history, yeah, very accessible.
And do you know how much of that remains?
Well, it's been devastated, but some of the big ticket stuff, like Damascus, the old city of Damascus is okay, which is a base to rebuild from, definitely. Some of the Crusader castles have been damaged, but not obliterated, like Aleppo's. You know, Aleppo has been obliterated, unimaginable tragedy. And a lot of looting goes on. The trouble is, once the government, and we saw in Egypt as well now with Google Earth and various things, you are able, looting is a massive issue of these archaeological sites.
I see,
so the JCBs go in the minute the government, the police kind of are otherwise engaged. So it's a big problem.
Yeah.
But no, where would I think very few places I'd never go back to. I'm trying to think now. Do you know what? I'm falling out of love with... I loved America. And I'm falling out of love now with the uniform, like totally anodyne strip malls, same brand, same terrible food. I'm definitely the sort of the classic Midwest road trip. Like I no longer yearn to do that. You know, I don't. When you're young, culturally, you're like so desperate to get in a car and drive across the states and everything.
Yeah,
and now I'm like, actually, obviously, there's unbelievably wonderful place in the States, but I'm, you know, going to Houston and just that kind of Carmageddon, concrete, totally lack of individuality. I mean, of course, then you go to San Antonio and you go to Kansas City and you go to New York and San Francisco and you see all the opposite. Amazing, you know, wonderful. But I think I might be done with some of those big Midwest cities for the moment.
Mm. As you mentioned earlier, you know, get to Zion National Park, get to Monument Valley.
And New England. I mean, when I went to New England, I felt New England is like England, but just better. It is just the best. And when I was 18, I could have, there was a point at which I thought I might go to university there. And if I'd gone, I'd be there. I'd be Mr. like Massachusetts now, I think. I'd be wearing my car keys and supporting the Patriots and everything and talking about the Red Sox the whole time, because it's just heaven up there.
Yeah. So chapter 7, Dan, is your next big adventure.
So I'm off in a few weeks' time to St. Helena in the little island in the Atlantic.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So tell everyone a bit about...
So St. Helena is a little scrap of land in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, just south of the equator. I think it's just south of the equator.
One of the most remote places in the world.
One of the most remote places on Earth, discovered, quote-unquote, by Europeans, Portuguese, as they pushed ever further into the Indian Ocean. On the way to the Indian Ocean, they discovered it. It was owned by the Portuguese, and then by the Dutch, and then by the Brits.
It's off the coast of South Africa,
off
is it?
Off the coast, yeah, of southern Africa.
Southern Africa,
basically in the middle of the Atlantic between Brazil and West Africa, you know, kind of.
Extraordinary.
And it's famous because it was a useful island that you'd stop off and you'd get some supplies and put some coal on board if in your steamship and then head off to round to Cape Town and beyond. And it came to prominence, it's remembered because it's the place that the British sent Napoleon Bonaparte after he was defeated at the Battle of Waterloo in 1815. In 1814, Napoleon had been exiled to Elba, a small island off Italy, and he'd escaped when his British sort of guard was off visiting his girlfriend on the mainland in Italy. Napoleon escaped, captured France back, and fought the Battle of Waterloo. He was defeated again. This time the Brits were not going to make the same mistake, and they sent him to the most remote place they could think of, St. Helena, where he died. Where he lived in this house, and I'm off to see his house, and he wrote a autobiography blaming everyone else for his failures. Mm-hmm. And then he died, and then he was exhumed and taken back to Paris, where he is now in the Hotel des Invalides, which I'm sure many of you have seen. And the Brits always used to say that was the biggest mistake we ever made. We should never let the French get that body back, because they turned him into a sort of saint. Turned into a cult. But they did allow him back, and now you can still visit his grave, which has got nothing in it. And that's that. So I'm going to head out there. It's very exciting. They've just installed a very controversial airport there. They've spent lots of money building a runway that they discovered the crosswinds might be too much for planes' tolerances. So it was briefly looking like the most expensive unused airport in the world. But I hope planes are landing there now.
So what will you be doing when you get there? So tell me about the journey, first of all.
So you have to fly to Johannesburg.
And it's quite far, though, from Johannesburg, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's a proper mission from Johannesburg as well, yeah.
So
hopefully land safely. As with all my little trips, so we're filming for my history channel, History at TV, and then doing pods and stuff. But so do the history first, but then, because I love outdoor, you know, then spend the rest of the time coast steering, mountains, hiking, whatever, doing the other bits, because it's quite a wild scrap of land in the middle of the Atlantic. So I don't know, I'll report back.
Yeah, I look forward to hearing about
very
it.
Very soon.
Wow, so we're on to chapter 8, the final chapter, Dan, and that is what's at the top of your bucket list.
Well, my bucket list is entirely composed of remote islands. I love sailing, I love boats. I'm obsessed by kind of islands and island life. So there's a few that I want to go to. In fact, there's a lot. But in terms of bucket list, I think it's Sao Tome and Principe, which is in the Bight of Benin, and it's that big chunk that comes out of West Africa. And that is apparently astonishing. I met a member of the British embassy team in Nigeria, and they said that's where the smart cookies go, is you try and get out there, because it's just mind-blowing. And by the same token, an area that I've never been before, never been to the South Pacific, from the Easter Island right across. I've been to New Zealand, but from any point east of there, I haven't been. So would love to sail in between those islands and Micronesia and all that kind of stuff. That is just a dream.
Mm. Even though you could get seasick.
Well, the seasickness, but partly as a result of my brutalised childhood, like that, I just got over the seasickness. So
I
no longer get seasick, because it just my body gave up worrying about it. So I owe that favour to my dad.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Dan. Those were your travel diaries. It's been such a pleasure.
Thank you.
That was Dan Snow and his travel diaries. All the destinations mentioned by Dan I've included in this episode's show notes. Dan Snow's History Hit is available wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like that, check out his online history channel, historyhit.tv. Thank you so much for listening today. Across the next couple of weeks, I'm having a Mr. and Mrs. Smith giveaway with some special prizes. Simply leave this podcast a review wherever you listen to your podcasts and send me a screenshot. You can reach me at Holly Rubenstein on Instagram or Twitter. If you previously left a review, send me that too. Entries will be selected at random and I'll be back in touch if you're a winner. Next week is a mid-season break. I'll be traveling myself to a far-flung location. I'll let you know about that when I get back. And I'll be back the week after with a really fantastic guest that I can't wait to share with you. So have a great couple of weeks and I'll speak to you soon. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden, and my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.